Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Episode 56, Lawyers Can't Rap.
This Week in Law is brought to you by Audible. For your free audiobook, visit audiblepodcasts.com/TWiL.
Hi, this is Denise Howell, and you've tuned in for TWiL, This Week in Law, Episode 56. It is Friday, April 16th, and here with us today is Merlin Mann of 43 Folders, Hot Dogs Ladies. Hello, Merlin.
Hi, Denise. How are you? Thank you for having me on.
It is a thrill to have you on. We're
you
all big fans,
say.
Of course.
Well, it's very cool. It's very cool. I appreciate you, I don't have any law background. I actually dropped constitutional law. It was just too much reading.
Oh, but I was reading your bio and read that you used to do courtroom exhibits.
We did. Are you curious?
I am curious.
You should probably do your other intros. But
yes. Well, we'll share first and then we'll introduce everybody else.
It was my first real job. I had an office. I made, I don't want to make anybody feel bad about their salary, but I was pulling in $22,000 a year. And I made courtroom exhibits and did line editing and deposition summaries, later mostly courtroom exhibits, for litigation support for toxic tort litigations. So,
awesome.
Yeah, because basically all these giant companies used to just write a check for $50,000 if you claimed that your, sleep apnea came from PCBs.
Right.
So anyway, yeah, so I would have to show like how many, how many bowls of cereal you would have to eat to get the baseline dosage of PCBs, which you didn't have.
So, well, all
it was
I can
a really
say
cool
is
job.
I would much rather have you doing courtroom exhibits than a lot of people who are in that business. So it's kind of a tragedy you got out of it.
If any of you, this is an open offer, seriously. I mean, if any of you ever need me to put together something regarding cornflakes or PCBs, dioxins, I'm not totally up to date on the literature, but just, let me know. I'm happy to do it for you.
Right. You can probably
my
skip,
husband
you know,
and Evan
book.
Here, who we'll introduce next, Evan Brown from internetcases.com. Both hey. Still try cases. Hey, Evan, how are you doing?
Good. Happy Friday. Thanks for having me on the show.
Great to have you back on the show as well. And my husband's big complaint is that all of their technical advisors for the courtroom don't know what they're doing and wind up doing sort of kludgy PowerPoint presentations that put the juries to sleep within 5 minutes. So is that your experience too, Evan?
Yeah, it totally defeats the purpose. There's just some kind of ghost in the machine that manifests itself at the worst time. It's the same. It might be a first cousin to the same ghost that gets into your machine when you're on the phone talking to somebody and, you're trying to either, find the information really quickly and the other person's a little bit impatient with you. And that's when, you're going to have a hard time finding what it is, or the computer will crash, or a lot of Mac users on this conversation. So you may not have the same experience. But when I'm at work doing my work-related computing and not home doing my serious computing on a Mac, that's when those types of things inevitably happen. Same thing going to court. That's always when when all the stuff's going to hit the fan for sure.
It's always a deadline. You notice there must be some plugin. I don't know if it's something. I don't know if it's an Apple thing. I don't know if it's a BSD thing. But the tighter the deadline and the angrier you are about how behind you are, the more likely that you're going to crash. In my experience, with nothing saved.
Yep, inevitable.
Right. And Carolyn, our third panelist besides myself, Carolyn Wright. I'm not sure. Do you try cases or not?
Absolutely. Actually, I'm on a trial calendar starting the 26th down in Miami, Southern
fabulous.
District of Florida.
Now, Carolyn blogs and writes and otherwise has her online world at photoattorney.com. And she, understandably enough, is a photographer's attorney and a photographer yourself, yes?
Yes.
Very exciting.
You have some great photos on your blog. That's one of the best parts about reading it.
Oh, thank you. That's my photo of Bryce Canyon and the snow behind me. There we go. Don't have too much in my office, but that one's kind of nice.
Oh, I like your office. For those of you who are listening to the audio, you can always catch the video of our show live Fridays at 11 o'clock at live.twit.tv on the internet, on your iPad, all sorts of outlets for joining us live for the show. And yes, Caroline, I like your office quite a bit. One of our former panelists on the show asked me afterwards if I do the show from my laundry room. And I assure you that this is my actual office too.
It does look like a washer and dryer behind you.
Yeah, that's what he said. No, those are cabinets.
Yeah.
And I spin my computer around so you don't get the plain old blinds that I have behind my desk, which are pretty boring.
Is that the view we used to have in the first when we first started doing video? I know that there were some blinds.
Yes, which, you know, is okay, but I figured a little artwork in the background was nicer than that. Anyway, so Merlin, we're having you on the show this week, not just because we love you and want to ask you all kinds of stuff about what you do, but particularly because you had your own little legal episode lately. And could you just let us know what happened and what you did about it?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's legal. I guess I would leave it up to you guys to decide what the exact legalities of it are. I mean, the facts of it, as I understand it, I first learned about this from Dan Weinman, who's a pal of mine on Tumblr and Twitter and stuff. And I guess, I think it was Dan that had first mentioned that there was this book that had appeared on Amazon and I think in retail outlets. And it was basically another one of these like collections of like funny Twitter posts, you know, it was tweets. So it turned out that a lot of people, see how I'm being very, I'm parsing all of this in a way that a lawyer would appreciate. To my knowledge, I'll just say my stuff that appeared in there, I'd never heard anything about it being used. It's my understanding that a lot of people basically appeared in this book that had never given any permission. And, you know, just to be clear, it was a commercial book. You know, it's for sale. You know, this was not to, like, you know, help cripple children or anything. It was for sale.
Before you go further, let me jump in and add a little bit of context, because mm-hmm. although it's unfathomable to me that we have people who are listening to the show live or may listen to it after the fact, who don't, you know very well who you are, Merlin, but extent that
I think that's a very safe assumption.
I should, you know, introduce you briefly and let people know that Merlin is a brilliant writer and thinker and productivity specialist, and also is one of the greatest personalities on Twitter around. I mean, so funny, and just what you're able to punch into 140 characters is literally a work of art on a minute-by-minute basis.
Thank you. That's really super cool of you to say. Thank you.
You know, upwards of 67,000 people feel the same way and follow Merlin on Twitter. So when someone begins to look at his work on Twitter, there is quite a bit of force and creativity behind those works. So now, with that said, please go on.
Yeah, I mean, just to give just the tiniest bit more context to that, I mean, I think I'm part of the the second wave of Twitter users. The first wave of Twitter users, mostly the people at Obvious, and you know, which became Twitter. You know, were the folks who were like, yeah, you know, had some Thai food, went on a run, and I think I was part of that second wave of people who just used it wrong. And it's actually how I met some of my best friends now. People like, I do this podcast, You Look Nice Today, and with Adam Lissagore and Scott Simpson. And those are Lonely Sandwich, you might know him better as. Two of the absolute funniest, best guys on Twitter. And so I've made all these friends because all of us were basically using it as a platform to, you know, I think you put it nicely. I mean, it's kind of a question of what can you say in 140 characters that, you know, is more than I ate some Thai food and had a run. Not because that's necessarily unacceptable, but because it was a fun challenge. It was a fun writing challenge to look at the economy of what you would have to bring to that and try to say something that entertained people.
Right, and Thai food and running don't always go all that well together. So you've got to be constructive somehow.
I got to say, I think it depends on how good the Thai food was and how good the run was.
Right.
I don't know. That's the beauty of Twitter. Michael Lopp says, you know, the best thing about Twitter is you never have to see anything you don't want to see unless you don't want to see it. But just for context here. So yeah, there's a whole group of, you know, idiots like me that, you know, have like a kind of a persona on Twitter and like say things, and you become well known, you know, for, in my case, like being an internet jerk, which I hope is not entirely true. But yeah. And so, I mean, a lot of people like it, and that's an honor and a thrill. But what's happened is there've been several of these books, because let's be honest, it's pretty easy. You just go copy and paste a bunch of these things. You get some people to sign a form, and then you can go sell a book. You know, and personally, I have turned down, I think I said yes to my friend Dom, who did a really good book on basically Twitter etiquette that I thought was outstanding. Dom Segola's book is terrific. But no, I don't want to be in this. I didn't want to be in it. I turned down everybody who's been kind enough to ask just because it's not something I wanted to do. But so anyway, to what happened here, basically this book came out. It was on a professional publishing imprint. I'd never heard of them, but... So then I think the thing that a lot of us became aware of was they went out and I guess wanted to try and get in front of this, ironically enough, way too late by sending a bunch of form letters to everybody via email and saying, hey, I'll never forget this. They said, we really regret not having asked your permission before we use your stuff. And I mean, in a way that I hope I'll get to talk about, you don't really get, they didn't get why I didn't want to be in there. You know, it wasn't just that like, oh, sorry, we accidentally honored you by putting you in this book. I was kind of, getting that letter is what kind of galled me was that this was going to be this fake apology from somebody who expressed regret, but didn't regret it enough to have had the basic, what I would consider the basic job description of both an editor and a publisher. An editor's job is to make sure everything that's in there should be in there. And a publisher's job is to attract and contract talent with a certain degree of exclusivity implied. And I didn't have any of that. So it was frustrating to me. And I actually kind of took it up as a cause because I thought it was not cool. Secondarily, because it pissed me off, but primarily because I just think it's not cool to not acknowledging the distinction between this is free for you to enjoy versus this is free for you to do whatever you feel like and potentially even sell. And you know, in an age where Creative Commons in particular has gotten us thinking about this sort of licensing stuff with a little more nuance, and certainly where things like the peer-to-peers and file sharing have gotten us all in a different mindset about what we own, I thought it was a really interesting conversation. I was happy to contribute to it. So my biggest contribution to this was I went and did, I think, my first ever one-star review of a product. But I went to Amazon and I said basically, hey, you know, I'm leaving this mean review because you guys, you know, didn't ask. And it's not cool. And I had a little bit of a Jeremiah ad about just saying, look, I'm happy to say, I don't want to sound immodest, but any success I've had has been because I gave stuff away. But just because I gave it away doesn't mean it's not mine anymore. And so that's why I say I'm not sure if it's a legal issue. It may be. The different people, my friend Jeffrey Zeldman, among other people, have said, you know, they don't think there's any basis for saying you can copyright this stuff. But from my point of view, you know, the thing that the unspoken part of this has been, this is not substantial real stuff, right? It's short and it's dumb and nobody cares. Well, it may be short and it may be dumb, but that doesn't mean I don't care. Somebody like William Carlos Williams wrote very short poems. Does that mean you can go grab all his poems and sell them in a book? Just because you think the photographs aren't good, can you just grab them off of Flickr and make them into a book?
I think we've actually established on this on the show before that The Red Wheelbarrow, one of William Carlos Williams' best work, fits in 140 characters, and nobody's going to argue that that's not something creative enough to be subject to copyright.
Well, you know, again, now this is where I'm going to really go beyond my any of my competencies, and I'm just going to say that, you know, by extension, if I went and scooped up, let's say I wanted to go out and make poems or another one, if I just said, oh, I want to go collect what I consider some of the best short fiction of the late 20th century. If I just went and grabbed 10 Raymond Carver stories, well, you know, somebody in the Carver estate is not going to like that. Now, if your distinction in that is, well, like Twitter's stupid and therefore it's okay to take it, I'm not really sure that's true. And maybe that's more of a reflection of how you, what craft you put into it than what I do. But second, there's a tautology to this, or like at least a paradox. Like if it's valuable enough to sell, it's valuable enough to buy. And if you're going to be cynical enough to grab this stuff and steal it, then you know, on the face of it, understand that there's value. So, you know, it's kind of the Ronald Reagan problem. You're either incompetent or you're a liar. With all respect to the Reagan people.
Well, you know, on this, I see a distinction between the short stories and Twitter. And it's you know, it's not the distinction that I think Twitter is stupid, because I obviously love Twitter and love it. And you know, the thing that I've been, the way that my curiosity has been piqued, Merlin, by what you've written about this is to wonder where the line is that was crossed here that the book author crossed by putting it into a publication like this, how that's qualitatively different than if somebody were to, you know, just take the feed from your Twitter stream or even select one at a time and, you know, throw them on their Tumblr blog or another blog and, you know, and maybe even have some ad revenue coming in around the edges on that. Where's the qualitative line that really you got, you think was passed and made this something objectionable, as opposed to something that's done more in the spirit of social media and sharing and take? I mean, I doubt that you would have you know, problems with somebody taking a few tweets here and there and putting them on their site, you know, at least giving you some props for it in the process, right? I know I've asked a couple questions there. I'm just kind of throwing that out.
I think it's great questions. And the truth is that I think you're actually asking some really substantially different questions, all of which pass the test in this instance, in my mind. Again, I'll steer clear of the law stuff because I have no idea.
Yeah, we don't know what it is either. We just kind of make it up.
Well, I mean, for example, one thing I was just thinking about in trying to kind of mentally prepare for this, has there been a really good test of Creative Commons yet? I mean, because as I understand Creative Commons, everything I do pretty much is a by NCND 3 license, which says you can use this for non-commercial stuff as long as you don't change it and as long as you don't credit me, which I consider for myself, you know, a pretty liberal policy. I think it's one that a lot of people have adopted. But as to my understanding, that does not mean I reject my the very rich body of law around copyright.
Right. No, that's the whole purpose of Creative Commons.
Right.
Is that
and so, I mean,
it keeps
somebody
copyright
like,
in place, but lets you permit various uses that you're deciding in advance are okay.
Right.
And there was a great case, by the way, as far as testing the Creative Commons, there was a great case in Jacobson v. Katzer that was within the last few months. And it was open source software that was licensed for use that you had to do attribution. And it had something to do with railroad trains, some sort of software like that. And Creative Commons Society came in and did an amicus brief for that case, but basically saying that that was a condition of the license, that you had to do the attribution, and without the attribution, it was an copyright infringement. Whereas the defendant was saying this was a breach of contract when they didn't attribute the software, the new version of the software. So there has been this recent test, and it actually came out very well for the plaintiff.
Right, and that definitely would, you know, be an arrow in the quiver of one trying to argue Creative Commons. There was another situation, not under U.S. or not in the U.S. courts, but with Adam Curry a few years ago over in a Dutch court. Do y'all remember that one?
Yep,
Denise, I know
well.
We've talked about it on the show before.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Where?
What was that? What happened with that?
Oh, it's been, you know, it's probably been four or five years. But essentially, I think the Dutch court held that the Creative Commons license that he'd put on some Flickr photos was enforceable. I don't know, you know, if they went into much more nuance other than that. I know that it was they published some photos that he'd put out under one of the Creative Commons licenses that didn't permit commercial use, and one of the tabloids picked it up over there. Their defense was, well, it was set to public, you know, on the Flickr setting. You know, he had it set there, and so, you know, obviously confusing those two notions as to the applicability of the Creative Commons license and just the Flickr designation. But what we know from that case is that at least in Holland, it sounds like they will acknowledge the validity of these and at least look to the terms and what they say. And then there was just a minor issue that involved where the facts involved Flickr, but it didn't really get to the copyright question. It was the Chang case, Allison Chang. But that was more of a right of publicity where Virgin Mobile used a Creative Commons license photo off of Flickr in some advertisements, but they never really got to the copyright question on that. So I know, Merlin, you ask, has it really been tested? And I think that we can, that what Carolyn's pointing out with the Jacobson versus Katzer case, which is, you know, the open source context, that's the best guidance we have on it, because that whole notion, that whole idea of slapping a license on something and making it available, even though you don't know who's going to pick it up, that notion has been and been validated in as much as what that case will tell us.
Well, and it's also, I mean, my pal Matt Howe used to work at Creative Commons, and I think one of the things that has made Creative Commons so interesting from the beginning is that, I mean, I don't remember the exact sequence of events, but one of the first things they did was create basically a machine readable license. You know, an XML-like format where, you know, now if you there's a lot of blog engines and different kinds of sites where you can go, including Flickr, where you can go in and programmatically say, I'm associating this license with my work unless I say otherwise. So it's not I mean, I you know, I'm sure, you know, Twitter's got a lot on their hands in terms of functionality on the table right now. But I wonder if one solution might be to say the default state is copyright, all rights reserved, unless you tick off a radio button that says, no, my stuff is usable under these terms, and throw the machine readable license. I mean, as APIs and stuff get more involved, you know, I realize this stuff gets hard. And I just really do want to clarify, you know, this is the part that I wish it wasn't so difficult for me to explain or for other people to understand. I mean, the Inbox Zero video that I was in, my talk on Inbox Zero that I did at Google, I mean, I can't even tell you how many hundreds of thousands of times that's been seen. It's a huge honor. In fact, if I tried to collect a nickel every time somebody watched that video, I would not have a career. I am honored to be included in that. I would not be honored if somebody downloaded it and decided to sell it on a DVD and then claim that I, or infer that, imply that I had permitted that. And this is the part where it gets a little subtle for some people. There's the subtlety of like, oh, who cares about Twitter? There's also the subtlety of, hey, I want to pick what neighborhood I live in. You know, I am super picky about a lot of stuff. You may not think that to like read what I do, but like I pick my friends and I pick my clients and I pick my outlets really clearly. And, you know, to me, one of the things, just to your point about what, you know, what happened here, I think when you sell something that somebody else has made, you're doing several things. You're implying several things. You're implying that that person agreed to do it. You're implying that that person, you know, sort of licensed it and said you can do it. And you're implying a relationship that simply does not exist. It would be like photoshopping me into you know, a picture with you and acting like we're pals. And, you know, if that doesn't matter to you, it should, you know, because I think when we stop acting like there's a difference between these things, we endanger some of the most interesting things that are happening. I'm sitting here right now looking at Richard Stallman's Wikipedia page, and then I went and just looked at Richard Stallman's homepage. You know, Richard Stallman, Linus Torvalds, Dries, the guy who does Drupal. I'll bet you that to a person, pretty much everybody who has ever done some kind of a giant project in open source has copyrighted the name of it. Even though with somebody like Stallman, you're going to have to walk a pretty long way to find somebody who's a harsher critic of copyright. But he understands enough to know that if he doesn't copyright it, somebody else will, and then they can claim that it's their thing, and they can do all kinds of really screwed up stuff with it. So right. At the heart of it, I'm most interested in copyright because it keeps me in control of stuff that matters to me. I just want to underscore that I'm a pretty harsh critic of people who get too obsessed about this stuff. Because I think if you're going to be on the web and you're going to be out there, you're going to have to develop a tolerance for stuff being used in ways you hadn't expected. But I think at the point when a company that's theoretically run by adults starts taking people's stuff and selling it, I think you have to say that's not okay.
Merlin, you may have another type of recovery there. Instead of copyright infringement, if copyright law won't cover your tweets, it's a tough decision as to whether it would rise to the creativity level. You often have other state court claims that that you could make, such as unfair competition for the use of your tweets, possibly right of publicity issues there. So it's something that you could investigate further. It doesn't have to be just under a copyright infringement claim.
That's another part, though. So just so people know, I mean, I think one thing that kind of brought this to a head, I have to say, if you showed that post a few minutes ago that I wrote on Kung Fu Grip, well, the review that I left at this point has over 800 people saying that they whatever agree with it. You know, I'm not a fan of this kind of mob mentality, but I think that's what got these people's attention. Is I went in and said this is not cool. And again, I'm at the risk of sounding a little bit nuanced and fancy. There is no recovery for me if you. You may not consider it a big damage, and it's certainly nothing I can't recover from. But you know, the damage is done in the sense that you went and you did this thing. I don't want your money. If I take your money, even if it's in a court of law, I'm implying that like now it's settled. Well, it's not settled. You screwed the pooch. And me taking
and
money,
odds are it sounds like also, these people had come to you beforehand, you would have said no.
Clearly.
It's not something you were interested in being involved in.
And here's the thing, though. I mean, I have a really strong feeling about this. When I say I'm picky, I mean I'm picky. I reject a lot of clients every month because I won't work with them. Because to be honest with you, that like makes all the other ones more valuable. This is the nut of everything I try to do in every discussion, everything I try to say to every company I work with. If you don't acknowledge this scarcity, then you're dead in the water.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say the final thing then, though. So all I was going to say was, I'm sorry to rant on, but the last thing was just that, you know, if I take money from you, if you like PayPal me a buck because you feel bad about it, you know, legal stuff aside, you know, I'm not going to accept it because you don't even get to pay me. I believe it or not, I even get to decide who gets to pay me. And I think people seeing this from a certain middle distance or further go, oh gosh, I'd be really honored to have somebody. Well, good. Well, that's your decision, right? But people who say this stuff doesn't matter may not be making stuff that matters. When you say, I don't care how people use my stupid stuff, well, maybe that's because your stupid stuff hasn't become valuable enough that you need to start thinking about it. And you do need to start thinking about it. If you want to become Jonathan Richman, you're going to have to, Jonathan Colton, you're going to have to get to the point where you go, this is okay. You can do this, but you're going to have to pay me and get my permission to do that. So I started doing Creative Commons just because I wanted to say, hey, it's cool to use this. But I think we need to start being clearer with one another about saying that easy to use does not make it easy to sell. That's my net.
Mm-hmm. Well, what you were expressing there about not necessarily wanting to get paid, I think is an expression of a sentiment that really is deep within the law as it applies to the remedies for copyright infringement. And Carolyn, this is something that you know, I hope you'll chime in and talk about too, because it's something I'm sure that's near and dear to your heart and your thought processes when you're representing clients who are making claims of infringement. And that is this whole notion of irreparable harm for infringement. And this leads us down some interesting pathways of discussion in talking about what it really is, what the harm is when copyright is infringed. And one of my big pet peeves, and I don't, you know, call people out on this because it's so much into our common lexicon, but one of my big pet peeves is when people refer to content theft or saying, you know, some of my work has been stolen or something like that. Copyright infringement, you know, is not in the nature of theft. It's more in the nature of trespass. You know, when somebody infringes on your copyright, you're not deprived of any ownership of that thing. You know, Thomas Jefferson talked about this. And I think now that I'm mentioning Thomas Jefferson, I think I've mentioned this on the show before as well. But this whole notion of infringement being something that's just there, and it's really even more harmful than theft in a certain sense, because it can't be remedied with money. That seems to be what I hear you saying, Merlin. And it's interesting to hear that notion percolate up from these feelings that you're having about what's happened in this situation.
There's this quote that yes, absolutely. There's this quote that Lawrence Lessig used in his I think one of his best known presentations. I think it was Lawrence Lessig. This is a quote from Jefferson: "He who receives an idea from me receives instruction himself without lessening mine, as he who lights his taper, candle, at mine receives light without darkening me." And that, to me, is the spirit of Creative Commons writ large, which is
that's
that
exactly the quote I was thinking about, too.
Yeah, so. Precisely. But you know what? You're not allowed to grab my candles and sell them. I understand that, you know, I still, in this case, yeah, but I mean, it doesn't mean you get to go, like, you know, say that those are your candles.
Right. You know? Right.
So the chat room wants us to dig a little deeper here on the question of the copyrightability of tweets themselves, because they're public, because they're short. I think those would be the two primary pushback areas. And I guess another issue would be how much of Merlin's works were actually used. Carolyn, you want to give us some thoughts on that?
Well, copyright law covers literary works, which that's where the tweets would fall in. It does have to. You can't copyright short phrases. And so then, is a tweet a short phrase, or is it prose? Is it poetry? Does it generate enough creativity? That's what copyright protects, is creativity, creative works, when they are transfixed. And so it's a question as to whether each individual tweet, it doesn't have to be a certain length, as to whether it would be copyrightable. So it's a question for a court, and each tweet would be probably given a different analysis. I mean, after the analysis, have a different result, just as fair use. Some things are fair use and sometimes they're not, and it's hard to sometimes to tell the difference.
Right. I haven't read the book, Merlin, but it sounds like this book, which is called Tweet Nothings. Folks were asking about that too.
Great name.
Yeah.
Well, a pretty ironic name if you think about it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what you titled your review. My tweets are not nothing. Yeah. But anyway, it sounds like they used a lot of your tweets. I haven't read it, but there was quite a bit in there.
I didn't buy it. I haven't read the book. But you know, let me ask you this, though, because I think that's a super interesting thing. Everybody who has a website that, you know, can appear on the internet has had their sites, had their feed scraped, for example. And that's usually, I mean, let's be honest. I mean, nobody's going to really confuse whether that's your site or not. Some people get really wound up about it. I don't get that wound up about it. I mostly got wound up just because I would worry about the Google penalty on duplicate content, which is a real nerd thing to worry about. But I guess I'm curious if you, just to that point. Okay, so from the pseudo legal aspect, I see a distinction between taking something of mine, and this is trivial in the sense of being one thing. But when you collect something, I guess the question I ask is, when do you cross a line in terms of how often and how much? It's one thing to quote something; it's another thing to quote it without attribution, and it's quite another thing to quote the full text of everything you've ever done programmatically. And like all legal things, I think it becomes most interesting when you try to look at the continuum rather than the two ends where it's easy to figure out. So, I mean, has there been anything established with that in terms of, like, I look at RSS, stuff like that. I mean, is there any law about this, the law out there that's up to date on what happens? Is there a difference between 1 and 5 and between 1 and 100? You know, to me, the collection matters here. The fact that you chose to go out and do this, you thought it was valuable enough to sell. You know, if, like I say, if you went and printed this out and did it for yourself on Lulu or, you know, Blurb or whatever, I mean, I wouldn't have any concern personally about that. What, and is there anything to that?
I think that's where the more intriguing copyright issues come up here, and the selection and arrangement of these things, because we can set aside the question about whether or not an individual tweet is copyrightable and still have this conversation about whether or not the intellectual effort that goes into picking out good tweets and separating the bad ones and making them topical and putting them in context with other tweets and things like that. That indisputably is an effort of intellectual effort that's going to rise to the to what lawyers call the Feist level of originality. That's a, you know, Supreme Court case from 1991 that really sets the standard for, you know, when is something original enough to be entitled to copyright protection here. That really is intriguing and is, you know, a way to circumvent or get around this more, perhaps problematic question of whether something that's just 140 characters is original enough. With that said, I have no doubt whatsoever, and I think I've said this before, I'm getting to the, you know, another repetition phase here. I have no doubt that some tweets are, you know, very clearly subject to copyright protection. We said already that, you know, the Red Wheelbarrow, William Carlos Williams, you know, it was things that Scott Simpson says, things that Merlin Mann say on Twitter, indisputably are original enough and much more than just rote facts. Things like just simple little links to something else, like check out this post about President Obama and a link to it. I mean, there's nothing creative there. That's not going to be something that is copyrightable. But there's more than one way to skin a copyright cat.
What if William Carlos Williams had posted it first on Twitter instead of jotting it down on a prescription pad and then having it published? Would that change? So in other words, is something that originates on Twitter going to necessarily have to be you know, trivial in the eyes of copyright? Or is it, I mean, I get what you're saying in terms of it could be just in terms of length, but is it actually the medium in this instance that changes the actionability of it?
I don't see a distinction. Does anybody else?
Yeah. No. Not at all.
I just think it's a shame. I just think it's a shame that, you know, I think this is a deeper issue at the center of this. It goes straight back to stuff like spam. The reason the internet works at all, the reason the web works is because it's open and because it's free and because there's nobody in the center saying what can happen. If you're not cool with that, you probably shouldn't be on the internet. You should lock your stuff up in a tower like a beautiful virgin that's now, you know, nobody's allowed to look at, you know. But I mean, I think in order to, like, I'm sorry to get on a soapbox here. Well, actually, I'm not sorry. I think in order to make this stuff really work, though, we're going to have to accept a little bit more subtlety and nuance. And I have to be honest with you, I would be bummed to see this turn into a court case where it ended up restricting the good uses that we all are comfortable, most of us are comfortable with. Do you know what I mean? In other words, I'm kind of glad that it's, yep. I don't personally, from a legal standpoint, I don't mind. I'm not that harmed by people like some stupid book that nobody's going to buy. I mean, sorry, like, I'm not that worried about that. I am worried about those associations, though.
Right. That's the other interesting aspect of this. People in the chat room have been asking, okay, so what did Merlin do? Did he sue? No, he posted this very direct review saying pretty much what he's saying here on the show, that he's not cool with this and thinks that it should have been handled differently. And when you go and check out the book page for this on Amazon, it has, you know, something like 31 reviews at this point,
and it's no longer available. It's been
most
pulled.
Of them are one star, you know, so that this is the legacy for this book on Amazon. Its review trail is horrific.
Well, and here, let me tell you why. I mean, that's my fault. You're not going to, if you follow me on Twitter, which you shouldn't, you'll see that I'm constantly ragging these idiots who leave these one-star. You know, somebody goes and they jailbreak their phone and then complain, fail, crashes on launch. You know, it's so stupid. You know, dumb reviews. I hate that. And I hate that mob culture. You know, Clay Shirky's wonderful book, Here Comes Everybody. It's something everybody should read because it's such a great overview. Not even overview. God, that guy is smart. So smart. And talking about what we're getting and giving up with all of this mob mentality on the internet, essentially, the power of it, you know, as being this extremely sharp double-edged sword, you know. And so what now, of course, now I've had to resort to this thing that I'm loath to do, which is to go out there and gang up on these folks. I don't want to do that, you know, but that was my avenue in this instance. And yeah, I mean, from what I can gather, Dan Wyman again posted this. This is where I learned about it. If you go look at the product page for a tweet, Nothings. So I think that's the first time I've said the name. And the book's no longer on the market. I received an email from the publisher, a personal email from the publisher that I won't get into. But he said, you know, stuff. And I basically told him to contact my lawyer because I didn't want to talk to him.
Well, yeah, that's sort of the flip side of this is that, you know, it may well be a kind of a thing that winds up being in litigation anyway, even if you attempt to work it out on the internet,
because I can speculate on
what that letter would say. I can't really think in my own mind that there would be any kind of legal basis against you here. But
there's one more piece of this that is just interesting, probably just to me. I have an agent and I have a book deal. I have a 3-book deal with HarperCollins, and I have an agent that gets a cut of any book that I'm in. And as I said in that post, my sense is that they did not go and talk to my editor at HarperCollins. They didn't talk to Michael Morrison. They did not talk to my agent. Now I sound fancy again, right? Well, HarperCollins has a deal with me that my stuff doesn't, they have like, I guess the equivalent of first right of refusal for anything I do. If I were at HarperCollins and I picked up a book that said featuring Merlin Mann, I'd have a lot of questions. So it does put me in a really awkward position. You know, I think. It's a first world problem that I'm thrilled to have. But I think, again, when you make all of these assumptions without understanding people's motivations, when you try to guess why they do what they do, you're always going to end up with unnecessary misunderstandings.
And what I was going to say earlier is that by doing what you're doing, going and giving the one-star review and having other people join in at their own volition, you know, maybe turning it into mob mentality, I mean, that truly is your best and most principled avenue of recourse in this because, as you said, you know, there's been this grand disintermediation. So there is little standing in between you and the one with whom you want to communicate or interact or make a point to. And so even if it's regrettable on a certain level that you did that, you know, if it's regrettable to yourself, if you regret having to do that, it truly is perhaps better than any other alternative that you might be able to formulate in the meantime. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, I didn't pick the pistols for this, right? They're the ones who chose to bring this up after it was in the marketplace. So as I deliberated over whether to do that at all, that was what went through my mind. You chose to start this in a store. And so that's where I'm going to finish it. And I'm happy that they pulled it. I think it was the right thing to do. But sending out a form letter to everybody saying we regret it and then not pulling the book is just strikes me as dishonest, you know? So, but you guys, your work is hard. So you basically sit around all day and you've got to figure out all these incredibly nuanced things and then some judge who might not understand it at all, you put it in front of them and you try and explain it, but it doesn't mean the right thing happens, right?
Yeah, absolutely. There are a couple of other good questions from the chat room I want to get to on this subject. One is a pretty basic one. Why does it matter if this was a tweet as opposed to something that somebody said just out loud? And that's because of the nature of the copyright law. Once you fix something in a medium of expression, such as writing or an audio recording, that kind of thing, that's what triggers copyright law to come into play. And then the other good question I saw there was related to books of quotations, which they had assumed were covered by fair use. Now, I've never actually looked into that, but that does strike me as something that could be a fair use situation, or it could be a situation of simply the very lengthy copyright actually having fallen out finally for you know, people what like about, Shakespeare, etc.
What if you just took a section of Poor Richard's Almanac and you grabbed, not now, obviously, but I mean, you know, that's all aphorisms. What if you grabbed a collection of Oscar Wilde's aphorisms in 1895 mm-hmm. and decided to put those out? Oh, it's just because they're short. Well, I think the collection, in my mind anyway, as a non-lawyer, the collection component of it matters. You willfully decided to grab these things. Somebody in the comments on that Amazon review made an interesting point. You know, is this, you know, substantial? I don't know if that's a legal term, but, you know, I think that kind of, you know, in the example, to your point, this example the guy gave was, oh, does a reporter have to ask your permission to give a quote? Well, no, on many levels. First of all, I knew I was being interviewed by that reporter. Second, he's taking it out of something that he elicited. You know, in the case of a book of quotations, I mean, I don't really have an opinion one way or another, but, you know, the thing is, if you acted like you had gotten those in an interview and you acted like you had gotten somebody's permission,
right,
you know, the implication here is that, like, this is some big honor that we all agree to be, like, you know, receive this very special award. And, you know, and that's that, I think that implication needs to be called out. So I don't know if that applies to quotations.
What do you think about that, Carolyn?
As far as quotations are concerned and whether it's a fair use, there has always been this rumor going around, urban myth, that you can quote a certain number of words, and the courts have found that that's not true. There's four factors that you look at under fair use: the purpose and the character of the use, the nature of the copyrighted work, the amount and substantial portion of the entire copyrighted work that was used, and the effect upon the market. So you look at those things, and generally, once something is determined to be used in commercial value, then it's rarely ever seen as a fair use. If it's used for advertising purposes, that would be a commercial use, and you would never have a fair use argument for that. But as far as the quotations, I think it was Ford's quote somebody took, and it was a fairly small amount of his quotation. This was President Ford. And they said they'd taken that the infringer had taken a substantial part of the entire work, and therefore it was not subject to a fair use defense. So again, it's one of these four factors, and the court is not even limited to looking at the four factors for a fair use analysis, but that's what those four factors are provided by the copyright law statute as to whether there's something as a fair use. And there's an interesting case just recently where the U.S. Postal Service took a photograph of the Korean War sculpture, and the district court said it was a fair use, and it was overturned on appeal, and the appellate court said it was not a fair use to have this photograph of the sculpture for the stamp, and so there was liability found.
Yeah, that case you were talking about with Gerald Ford's quotes, that was the Harper and Row case. Does anybody know how they're related to Harper or Collins these days? Maybe, Merlin, their sensibilities.
Yeah, you got to have a program to know one player from another at this point. It's very confusing.
Yeah.
Okay, so a couple of resources for folks out there flow from this discussion. Number one is something called TweetCC, which is still around, and we have a link to an article about it in the show notes, which you can find at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/56. And TweetCC is a mechanism for applying a Creative Commons license to your tweets, since Twitter does not itself do that, unlike Flickr, which does. And I wondered, since we have Carolyn on the show, if you could give us your thoughts on the automated Creative Commons mechanism that's built into Flickr, and what you think the ecosystem is that has sprung up around that, and its impact on use of works and copyright law in general.
Well, I have plenty of cases where there have been uses of photographs on Flickr. So it's sort of a bittersweet type of tool. Flickr's great to share your works, but unfortunately, it is also a mechanism, just like Merlin said, that you put stuff out on the web, it's going to get used. Unfortunately, or for a lot of my clients, it gets used in a commercial manner, even when there's been Creative Commons licensing explicitly put on the photographs. But the new tool, the bookmark tool that is a bookmarklet tool that's been talked about on Boing Boing, that's a fantastic tool, I think, to make it a lot easier for the proper attribution of a Flickr photograph.
Yes, and thanks for bringing that up. That's also in our show notes. It's our second resource of the week, the first being TweetCC. The second is Cory Doctorow put out a lazy web request on Boing Boing, and I forget exactly who responded to it, but it is in our show notes there. Someone made a little bookmarklet for giving attribution to Flickr photos, which makes it very easy to do when you're on the Flickr photo page. You just click the bookmarklet and it generates the text for you to embed. Speaking of the lazy web and things that flow from having Merlin on the show, Merlin, it strikes me that someone really needs to come up with some kind of productivity wrap for you. And so that's my lazy web request for the show.
You mean as in a hip hop song?
Yes, a hip hop song incorporating 43 folders and say, oh, I don't know, it could be like sort of boom, 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 boom.
What made you think of that?
If you got folders.
Uh-huh.
43's heaven. If you got,
I don't care. You can capture any way. You got to put it in your hipster PDA. God, I'm white.
Yeah. If you got signals, make it 37. If you got Sigma.
You represent make Chicago.
So look at my inbox. Got to be zero. Boom, chicka, boom, chicka, boom. You know, you need something like that. So there's my lazy web request for the show.
Wow.
I can't believe nobody's done that.
Not that I'm aware of. Right. You know, most of the people who are familiar with my work are nerds, you know, and so they don't really have like a musical thing. I mean, a lot of them listen to like Yes, you know, Rick Wakeman. They're you know, King Crimson. So you know, they're not big hip hop fans. A lot of them, you know, they're kind of confused. I don't think their mom has those kind of records in the basement.
All right. Well, we'll just have to see. You know, Our works at Twit here are under Creative Commons non-commercial attribution license. So,
I'm going to do this while we're on the air. CC attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives. Boom. There, I'm now licensed.
There you go. Oh, you did.
I'm sad to hear that. That's how we license the works, because I was totally going to, you know, burn a copy of that rap you just did and make billions.
Yes. Well, since I just rapped about 37 signals, I'm going to go ahead and use that as the lead-in for our Audible plug for the week. Over there on Audible, audible.com, which you can also follow on Twitter, which we've been discussing, audible_com on Twitter, there is a wonderful book called Rework. Have any of you guys read this? It is from the folks at 37 Signals.
No, but Merlin, they're good guys up there.
Yeah,
I haven't read the whole thing, but I got a copy. They sent me a copy, and I looked at excerpts, and it's terrific. I mean, it's, you know, you know, I think you're either a Jason Fried fan or you're not. But you know, yeah, I mean, it's the kind of stuff that, like, if you can put it in place, you should do it, and if you can't put it in place, you should figure out why you can't put it in place. It's a very like a lot of their stuff. It's very, very clever, very kind of polemic, but, you know, well thought out, and it's worked for them, you know.
Right. Well, the whole thing is on Audible. It is Ernie's Audible pick of the week in absentia. He sent this in to me and pointed out that Bob Lefsetz, who is somebody else that we talk about on the show quite a bit, great writer and thinker in the music industry, he read not the whole book, but just the excerpt of the book that you can download in PDF form from their site, and immediately fell in love with him. It hooked him has all sorts of great precepts about both being productive and being effective in today's day and age and economy in the digital world. So go check it out on Audible, Rework, from the folks at 37 Signals. And in order to do that, you can go to audiblepodcast.com/twill and actually get this or any other of the many, many tens of thousands of books available on audible.com for free. It can be yours completely free with no strings attached. You will be enrolled in the Audible Gold Listener Program, but that can be canceled at any time. I don't know why you would want to cancel it. It's $14.95 a month, and for that, you get one free book credit. Well, not free, you're paying for it at that point. You get a book credit each month, and everything is archived for you and available whenever you would like to go back and find them. I have Audible books in my library that I downloaded years and years ago that are still waiting for me to go listen to again at any time. So it's a wonderful resource. Thank you so much, Audible, for sponsoring Twill. And folks should go check out Rework. So, Carolyn, the other reason I wanted to have you come chat with us today is there is a big lawsuit pending that is sort of the second cousin to the Google book search lawsuit that we've talked about before that is in the attempt of trying to settle at this point, the large class action suit. There's a new suit that's been brought by photographers against Google over the same sort of basis of facts, the scanning of images in books. Can you tell us a bit about that and your thoughts on it?
Sure. Well, we all know about the Google book settlement or the Google book class action. And it became the photographers and visual artists, illustrators, graphic artists, became aware that the definition of the class in the Google book class lawsuit it's changed so that if you're a photographer and you had photographs in books, but you were not the copyright owner of the book itself. So let's just say that the publisher had licensed your photographs for the use in the book, then you would not qualify for proceeds under the Google book settlement. The efforts led primarily by ASMP, which is the American Society of Media Photographers, did an opposition to the Google Book settlement and tried to intervene in that to say that the visual artists were being left out of that. And Judge Chin said, sorry, we're too far along. This has really been designed just for text works. So really maybe the best thing is for you to go file your own lawsuit. Well, that's exactly what happened. That decision that Judge Chin handed down was in February, and then just this past week, ASMP and other visual art groups like and photography groups, illustrator groups have filed a class action against Google for their own type of settlement in order to try to recover or prevent Google from using the photographs in its scanning technology and at the Google Book Library. That's just gotten started. It's the attorneys, it's a law firm out of New York, and there's been some press releases issued for this new lawsuit, but it's fairly early in the stages.
Hey, this question is for all of you, and I'll start with Carolyn. How do you feel that, or do you feel that, the new sort of burgeoning world of mobile computing that is different from what we're used to with our desktops and our laptops and different than what we're used to with our phones, but the tablets that seem to be roaring at us like a freight train, beginning with the iPad and all of the competitors to the iPad that will shortly be out. How do you feel that that changes the landscape for images and the whole copyright discussion, Carolyn? Is there a qualitative distinction to be made when you're talking about a device that is always on and seems to be poised to be with people at all times?
I don't think so. It's just a different medium. And I don't see how that really changes copyright law or the protection that should be afforded to copyright holders. The issue is how money is made. And it changes with the medium. A lot of websites are made through get their money through advertisements, just like newspapers have done for years. But I don't think that it should change the scope of copyright protection.
Right. I guess what I'm kind of grasping at here is the notion that rights are parsed into so many different channels, you know, in book deals and music deals. You know, you can, the artist starts out with all the rights and then winds up signing away their rights to expression in one medium and then another and then another. And maybe they've taken into account the digital rights to the work and maybe they haven't. It just seems to me like this makes the digital side of things so much more important. I mean, that should go without saying, because everything on these devices will be viewable digitally. But it just seems that this ecosystem that is about to spring on us is poised to change so much. And I don't know, Merlin, do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, like 1,000.
Yeah, so sure.
Well, I mean, when I was talking to my pal, Mr. Hodgman, about the book deal that I've been offered and whether I should do it, we talked about, like, first of all, it's a good deal, but also about the difference. He's as a well-known former literary agent, he's just kind of contrasting what it's like to, like, work with somebody like The Daily Show versus work with somebody like a publishing house, and like how slow that ship is to turn. And even my friends who all work in publishing are really, but even on the best day, publishing is really slow to change. And I can give a couple good reasons and a couple bad reasons. I think a good reason is that it's a very mature industry. And like a lot of mature industries, those relationships are very well developed. Those Excel spreadsheets have stood the test of time. And I think that there is, there's a lot of reason, you know, well, let's be honest. I mean, my thing on this is, you know, if you've skated since the time of Thomas Edison on a certain business model, you're not allowed to be too bummed that it's changed. Because people have gotten by on scarcity and the protection of the law for a long time in a way that's ultimately been really consumer hostile. And they were very happy to stick with all of those things that benefited them and not consumers without changing a bit. I don't know if you remember 1982, 83, when CDs came out, all the talk was, oh gosh, you know, in a couple of years, these will be $3 a piece. Well, obviously that didn't happen because they continued to leverage that legal protection and scarcity. And now that the deck is not stacked in their favor, now all of a sudden they're all sad and bummed, and we're putting people out of work by not getting that. And so the problem becomes now, how quickly are you willing to not even just evolve, how quickly are you willing to basically redefine your entire job? This is something I talk about a lot in talks. And I think the problem becomes that the maturity of that industry is by its very nature kind of what holds it back. And again, Clay Shirky, who everybody should be reading all the time, Clay had a great thing about this, about, you know, these industries where it's just not going to happen. The whole nature of what they do is going to be impossible to change at the speed that's needed to keep them alive. Just because it's literally impossible. So, I mean, this is where us little, you know, nerdy guys actually have kind of an advantage, is that because we have to define what we do every day, we have to keep our eyes open to what the next thing is going to be. And we have the agility to do that without having too much skin in the game. And even if you have a mature property, you always have to be asking yourself, to quote my friend Matt Howey, I mean, all of us are one Firefox extension away from not having a job anymore. If you rely on ad revenue.
That's a great
quote. But anyway, so I don't know. I mean, am I saying contradictory things? Almost certainly. I want my publisher to make a lot of money for my book. I want to earn back my advance. I want it to be great. But I mean, I also understand that none of this stuff exists in obscurity. And anybody who thinks that they can just go, you know, call a lawyer and keep having this one way they make money forever needs to grow up. And, you know, again, if you're going to leverage the economies of scale and openness of the internet, you also need to accept a certain amount of risk about what that bought you. And if you think you're just going to show up, get free PR and marketing, and never, you know, have anything that you have historically thought of as bleeding, well, get ready to bleed, you know? And maybe instead of blaming the people who are bleeding you, maybe try and find a business model that lets them spend lots of money, you know? So, I don't know. I don't like seeing my stuff. Obviously, I don't like seeing my stuff abused, but it's hard for photographers. They end up really screwing themselves over. They do these crazy things with flash, and you know what I mean? They do all this stuff where I'm sure, Carolyn, is that right? Your clients must be facing that left and right. How do I expose my stuff to a giant amount of people, but still give myself 100% level of insurance that it will never show up on, you know, somebody's homepage? And the answer is kind of no, right? I mean, it's not going to happen.
Absolutely not. I mean, that's how I have a practice, is because the photographs are ripped off every day. But what we have trouble with, photographers mostly, is when it's used for commercial purposes. There's a lot of big companies that are using photographs without licenses, and it's it's astonishing, frankly, that people don't understand that you have to get a license. Now, whether my photographs get downloaded or emailed to people as for a screensaver or say, hey, look at this bear picture or whatever, that doesn't matter to me. I mean, I don't want that to happen, but I'm not going to stop putting my photographs on the internet for fear that that's going to happen. However, if a company used it in an advertisement, I definitely would go after that company. And that's what I do for my clients.
There's a funny phenomenon that I first noticed in 1995 when I first started doing fairly serious, you know, client services work. And I'm curious to see if you guys agree. In my experience, the people who end up being the cheapest and most suspicious of people who work by the hour are people who also work by the hour. Some of the cheapest people I've ever worked for are consultants and lawyers. I think I would be curious to hear what you think on that, because my analogy is, it's funny to me that the companies that are most torqued up about IP are also some of the ones that are fastest to leverage all this free stuff and basically take whatever they feel like and think that, you know, then it's kind of theirs. You know, who was it? Was a Virgin, you said, that grabbed, I remember that story. They grabbed a photo and, well, you know, I mean, certainly there's an element of, I can get away with this to that. It could be like the attribution problems in books. I mean, you know, it could have been an oversight, but, you know, I think something happens. I think something happened after Napster. I know it happened to me, where now it really feels like stuff is that easy to just grab. That's why I say, instead of trying to squelch that, why don't you try and find a business model that scales to try and, you know, harness that. But do you think lawyers are cheap?
I mean, inexpensive or miserly?
I'm sorry. Term of art. Skinflints?
Yes, there we go. Yeah, definitely we are.
Well, yeah, I mean, they definitely understand, you know, they, I'm referring to them in the third person as if they're this monolithic
all
other.
Those awful lawyers. Yes,
right. To all of the ones at the bottom of the ocean. You know, certainly they would tend to be more miserly, just like, you know, you're talking about with intellectual property owners being concerned about those things, because they're right there understanding, you know, what's at stake and how the process works and what the mechanisms are and what the ways to stretch the system. And, you know, one common thing that I share with my clients and trying to get them to understand that I'm going to be fair with them under a billable model, a billable hour model setup is, you know, I understand that you wouldn't hire, and I'm getting this from somewhere else, I don't know where I got it, but it didn't originate with me, is, you know, I understand you wouldn't hire somebody to put a new roof on your house, and they say that I'm going to charge you lots and lots of money per hour, but I'm also not going to tell you how long it's going to take or when, you know, when you could expect to see these stages of progress. So it's because, you know, lawyers and intellectual property owners are so close to the interest at stake, I think that they're poignantly or you know, very clearly aware of it in their own dealings. But what I really wanted to say was pick up on what you mentioned, Merlin, about there needs to be a real change here, and also to kind of tie that in with what you said, Carolyn, about how copyright, it really shouldn't change copyright, the way that things are becoming more mobile and everything's more open, there's more broadband, there's more stuff going on in the cloud, you know, we're always on all of this stuff. The law really applies in a certain way, and the change that needs to occur is not so much a legal one, but one that where the business models change and adapt to the environment that is set forth in the way that people want to generate or actually consume content, I guess generate and distribute it as users as well, but really to get content. And Denise, you know, you put up a couple of links to things from the Left Sets letter in our show notes. And these just really do a great job of getting to this point here. One is where he's talking about music. Well, I mean, obviously he's talking about music in both of them, but the model for selling music. And I think the intro or the basic premise, it was the notes I have here are track sales peak. I don't know if that was the title of his article, but
he's talking about digital tracks, you know, the tracks you can download from iTunes and Amazon and other sources and you're actually paying for. They have been, I guess, on a hockey stick growth pattern for a while, but now they're going down.
Yes. And
at $1.29 a track, that's not hard to understand.
Yes. And he's making the analogy and suggesting that it might be a good way of approaching this to look at music distribution in more akin to the way unlimited cell phone plans work and cable works. You know, everybody pays a little bit and has essentially an unlimited meter on what they get. And that seems to be the most plausible way of matching things up so that there's more harmony in the universe and everything's in better equilibrium, and to somehow resolve this tension between rights holders and consumers is to recognize that copyright can operate in this context, but there really needs to be some concerted effort among the policymakers and the decision makers and the people who can actually go out there and execute ways of selling content, making it available to match this environment, this ecosystem that you're living in, that you described as being always on, always connected, always mobile, always wanting content there, and not really wanting to go and buy a discrete, tangible unit of it at Tower Records anymore.
Mm-hmm. Right, and in the second piece he wrote, which is called Mobile, he points out the enormous growth, 30,000 new listeners a day that the music service Pandora is getting since it launched its iPad app, which I think was available on the very first day the iPads hit the stores and people's homes. And it's not hard to understand why. I mean, this thing just works. And the business model there is real obvious and real simple. It gets people hooked in. The quality is so good. You can, select the music that you like and have it suggest things you've never heard of, but you instantly fall in love with. I mean, it's just wonderful. It also, the iPad, I have to say, is what introduced me to Pandora. Having heard of it around the edges, it just doesn't, before I had this device in my life, Pandora or Rhapsody or some of these streaming music services just weren't things that made sense to me. They don't, on a desktop, I don't need music playing in the background. And, in our home entertainment system, we have other things going on, including Apple TV and all the music that we have in iTunes. But when you have this streaming service that so seamlessly integrates with a device as Pandora does with iPad, and when they are able to very subtly upsell you the fact that, oh, for just, $35 a year or something, any friction that you have in enjoying this music completely goes away, then, yeah, you're going to pay the $35 a year and you're going to be thrilled. Merlin, what were you going
to
say?
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. There's a phrase people use a lot. It's just kind of a throwaway phrase, but you say something's ahead of its time. And, that obviously that's the kind of thing we can only really, prima facie, only understand in retrospect. But, what's interesting to me is how our own understanding of this evolves as we get further out from what you might consider kind of the Napster era. But I mean, for myself, boy, I'm always amazed that companies they think the lesson of Napster is lockdown harder. And to me, the lesson of Napster is, wow, people really want stuff fast and they really want stuff cheap. And boy, if I were starting out a media business and I didn't have the same kind of nut to meet that a lot of these big companies have, that's what I'd be focusing on. And mm-hmm. and I just wonder kind of in general, how much of this stuff, sort of shakes out as we understand it a little better. For example, just as a resource, something I enjoyed, I don't know if you'll listen to public radio. There's a really good show called On the Media. And mm-hmm. They had a piece that first aired, I think, about a year ago. And it was an entire episode. I want to say, was it Adam Davidson? I forget who. But somebody did this whole long episode just about like the tumult of the music industry in particular. And kind of, it just covered different aspects by talking to different kind of stakeholders in it. And, along the lines of the Creative Commons thing that I mentioned, I had not learned, there's never been a real test of true, like, decision about sampling in hip-hop, for example. Like, I guess there's been things, obviously, where Biz Markie, they went, okay, look, you stole Gilbert O'Sullivan's song, you got to pay him. But there hasn't been, like, there's not super clear guidance, I guess, on sampling. Which is mind-boggling.
Nothing that anybody really wants to pay attention to. I mean, there's the Carolyn, I'm sure that you're probably up on this. I mean, everybody points to that Sixth Circuit decision. Mm-hmm. Is it Bridgeport, where it's just really a god-awful decision.
Super draconian.
Yes.
You can take nothing and like it.
This is that judge that totally didn't get it? Was the one judge that was like,
right,
basically
it
like
started out,
Mr.
Thou shall not steal.
Exactly. But right. Anyway, I think it's so interesting, and why I think your jobs are so fascinating right now, because you really are helping to kind of walk the unbeaten paths that will eventually be paved. And they're not going to change at that point. So anyway, if anybody's interested in that stuff, I think that is worth listening to. I heard it when it came out a year ago, and I heard it when it was rebroadcast a couple weeks ago. And even in that time, I got more of it, which tells me that like any of this stuff, as our understanding, as our use of it evolves, it becomes much less abstract. When somebody first told me what Twitter was, I said, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard of. It's still dumb. It's not the dumbest thing I've ever heard of. Now I get it because now I understand it. Now it's my friends. So I don't know. I just think all this stuff becomes so much more nuanced once you spend some time with it. And even the law, like now I get, now people get like why this stuff is an issue where it used to just seem really exotic and clearly about theft, you know?
Right. I think one of the most fascinating things about it all is because it's always a constant interplay between rights and obligations. And I'm talking at a very general level about the law and in particular the way it deals with technology. There's so many things that people have this innate desire to do and when they're being creative or being innovative, and there's always envelopes to bump up against, and you're always, seeing one party wanting to exert rights, and then you're going to see the incumbents, usually personified by big media, trying to put the smack down more often than not. So that it is really a fascinating dynamic, and it's great that you see that and can kind of see why we'd be passionate about it.
Yeah, Merlin, having you on the show has been a wonderful example of why we do the show, that there are nuances in these issues. They are not clear-cut. You're a great example of someone who has a very open-minded approach toward licensing and reuse, and yet to whom copyright matters. And, I think that's the world that we're living in, and that the courts and the legal system have to get themselves around and understanding. So thank you so much for coming and laying that all out for us. Folks can find Merlin at merlinman.com and also Hot Dogs Ladies on Twitter.
Save yourself the trouble. Don't follow me. It's just going to be sadness and regret, and you're just going to get mad at me. But thanks a lot for having me on. This is really cool. You guys seem really smart. So it's I'm glad you're out there fighting the good fight.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure. And I've actually wanted to have you on the show since you and I were on Twit long, long ago. So I'm glad that that we finally got to
Any
get this together.
Time.
Yeah, we'd love to have you back. Yeah. Evan, we have back all the time. And I'm so glad about that. Evan Brown at internetcases.com online and internetcases on Twitter. Thanks so much, yes. Evan.
Hey, thanks. This was an awesome time. Yeah, thanks for having me back.
Yeah, and Carolyn, thanks for joining our crew. It's been wonderful to introduce you to the Twill audience. Carolyn Wright, photoattorney.com, and photo attorney on Twitter.
Thanks very much. It's been a blast.
Great to have you, and we're going to keep an eye on this Google suit and all the things that are going on with imagery. Hopefully, we can have you as our go-to image expert here on Twill when we can pick your brain on these things that seem to come up all the time.
Sounds great. I would love that.
Wonderful. So after the show, if you'd like to check out the show notes there at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/56. This is our 56th show. We have a Facebook page at denise.howell.net/FB where we post pre-show questions, and we'd love to get your feedback on that. In fact, somebody posted a great comment over there that asks if adding info to a retweet, this was Alex Katadian, adding info to a retweet constitutes a derivative work. So maybe we can pick that up in our next discussion about Twitter and copyright, which seems to be an ongoing one on the show. So if you'd like to chime in there with us, we'd love to hear your thoughts. And I try and put up one or two things before the show each week. You can also contact me directly, denise@twit.tv. And we will see you all next week at 11 o'clock Pacific on This Week in Law 57. Thanks so much, folks.